Hi everyone, we're going to go ahead and get ready to get into the rental content. So this material comes from chapter 50 and chapter 51. So this slide is just pretty much to give you a briefing of the different parts of the rental system. One of the key components that the kidneys are responsible for is helping with controlling blood pressure and regulating it. And so we know this due to the RAS system. Normal adult urine output is 1500 mils per day. And so indicators for whenever a person feels like they need to go and urinate, 200 to 250 mils of urine causes moderate distension. And so this is going to initiate the urge to go and urinate. 400 to 600 milliliters, at this point, this is when someone feels uncomfortable. So two of the basic kidney functions, red blood cell production and regulation of the blood pressure, which you guys should be already familiar with this process. But just to kind of briefly talk about it, remember erythropoietin? That's a hormone that's made in the kidneys and it's secreted anytime there's a response to hypoxia or decreased renal blood flow. Erythropoietin is what stimulates the bone marrow to create more red blood cells. So anytime there is a deficiency of erythropoietin, this is going to lead to kidney failure, which leads to anemia, which is why chronic renal failure or end-stage renal failure patients are always anemic. So the kidneys, we know that they control the blood pressure, renin. This is going to be important in regulating blood pressure because it's made and secreted by the kidneys. So we know renin is released anytime we have decreased perfusion to our kidneys. Anytime there's a decreased blood pressure, decreased extracellular fluid, decreased serum sodium concentration, or if we have an increased urinary sodium concentration. So the RAS system will become activated. So once renin is released, kind of look at your graph and then it shows you how everything else comes to play. So of course, your angiotensinogen comes from the liver. That plus renin is how we get our angiotensin 1. Angiotensin 1 combines with your ACE inhibitor, your angiotensin converting enzyme, which is released from the lungs, and it converts to angiotensin 2. So angiotensin 2 stimulates the release of the aldosterone from the adrenal cortex, and so this will cause sodium and water to be retained. And this is what ultimately leads to an increase in our extracellular volume. So angiotensin 2, it causes vasoconstriction. And so that vasoconstriction is what's going to lead to an increase in the blood pressure because of those vessels tightening up. I placed these different tables on here just in case you guys wanted to briefly kind of look at the different lab values and different nephrotoxic agents and everything in regards to how you would assess your urinary system. It's not required, but I feel like it'll be helpful for those of you who have renal patients whenever you go and do patient pickup, because these are, it shows you the labs that are very important with this condition. So we have our first condition, glomerulonephritis. And so this is inflammation of the glomeruli. So this condition, it affects both kidneys equally and is one of the third leading causes of end-stage renal disease. So we have three different types. Acute, of course, we know the symptoms come on suddenly. They're temporary and can be reversed. With chronic, it's more slowly progressive and it could lead to irreversible renal damage. And then we have rapidly progressive. The key thing with acute, one of the most common types is post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. So whenever we're assessing these patients' history, we need to ask if they've had any recent infections, such as a sore throat, upper respiratory tract infection, or if they have a diagnosis of diabetes. So all of this is going to be key whenever we're assessing to kind of figure out what ended up leading to this condition. So the group A beta hemolytic streptococci, this is, it has nephrotoxic strands. So if it's caused based off of that, this is how it pretty much damages the kidney too bad, really bad. Now let's look at the manifestations of each type. So with acute, Fluid retention. So the fluid retention, this is going to occur because of the decreased glomerular filtration. So first, the edema is going to appear in low pressure tissues. So we'll start to see some periorbital edema. So that's the edema that's surrounding the eyes. Later, it will progress and involve the rest of the body. So that's when we have ascites and peripheral edema that will appear in the legs. So with chronic glomerulonephritis, we're going to see urinary excretion that's going to have red blood cells, have white blood cells, and casts in the urine. With rapidly progressive, we're going to have hypertension, edema, and hematuria. So rapidly progressive is like a combination of both acute and chronic symptoms. So when we're diagnosing and treating with acute, remember getting the history and physical on your patient is going to be important because we need to thoroughly assess and see what caused the condition. So the streptoenzyme test, this test, the purpose is to test for an immune response to the streptococci, and it's often seen by assessing the ASO titer. So dipstick and urine sediment microscopy, this can help reveal the significant numbers of erythrocytes because the erythrocyte casts, those are going to be your highly suggestive indicators of acute post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. We also want to look at our BUN and creatinine because this is going to let us know how bad it has damaged the kidneys. With chronic, we want to assess any exposure to drugs such as NSAIDs, if they've had any microbial infections or viral infections. So with acute post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, we're pretty much just going to be treating with symptomatic relief. And also with rapidly progressive, we're going to do steroids, cyclophosphamide, and plasmapheresis. And if it gets to the point where they end up going into end-stage renal disease due to this condition, dialysis and transplantation will be our treatment options. With glomerulonephritis, our goal is to try to prevent it from occurring. So early diagnosis and treatment of sore throat and skin lesions are going to be key with this, and we need to ensure that the patient has good personal hygiene. So anti-glomerular basement membrane disease, this is actually a form of rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis. So it used to be called good pasture syndrome, and so this is pretty much mainly a renal condition, but we'll start to see some respiratory signs with this as well, and this is because it damages the kidneys and the lungs. So with it, it has like the entire antibody reaction is going to be mediated by a complement activation, and this is why it's going to attack both the lungs and the kidneys with this condition. So we'll have respiratory symptoms along with renal symptoms. So this can quickly lead to renal failure, so it has to be managed quickly and properly. Our next condition is nephrotic syndrome. So with nephrotic syndrome, the glomerulus, it allows more plasma protein in than what it should. So this is going to lead to having an excess in protein. So this is why we're going to see proteinuria. And because of that excess protein that's coming in, it leads to less being out in the system. And so table 50.9 talks about the different causes of nephrotic syndrome. So due to the glomerulus membrane being more permeable to the protein, this is gonna cause for massive excretion of protein in urine. So we have, like I said, we have decreased total serum protein out in the circulation, and this is going to lead to edema forming. So ascites and anasarca develop if there's severe hypoalbuminemia. And so with one of the key signs of nephrotic syndrome is we're going to see foamy urine. foamy urine. And so with this foamy urine, they're fatty casts, which are actually like fat bodies. So with this condition, your patient becomes hypercoagulable. So this is going to place them at risk for developing arterial and venous thromboembolisms, PEs, DVTs, or even renal thrombus. So urinary tract obstructions. So with these obstructions, this is anytime we have an interruption in the flow of urine, and it can develop at any part along the urinary tract. So how bad it is going to be based off of where it's located, how long that obstruction lasts, the amount of pressure that it's causing, or if it's resulting in dilation, or if it's causing the urine to be stagnant or developing any infection. So, if any of the different obstructions continue on and it lead to the patient needing to have a diversion procedure done, these are the different types that we have. So, we have different diversion techniques and bladder substitutes. And table 50.23 talks about the different ones. So, the pictures I have here. So this one on picture A, this is going to be a ureteroileosigmoidostomy. B, this one is going to be an ileoloop, which is also called an ileoconduit. C, this one is a ureteroostomy. And this one right here is a nephrostomy. We're going to talk about each one of those on the next slide. The different types of urinary diversions, they're classified based off of incontinent, continent, or if the bladder was completely reconstructed. So our incontinent urinary diversion, this is going to be your ureteroostomy, your ileo, and your ileoconduit. So with the ileoconduit, no valve, the patient has no valve and no voluntary control over the stoma. So the stoma drops urine every few seconds. So with this, they're going to need a permanent external collection device. So kind of similar to how a patient with a colostomy has a colostomy bag, like they have no control over it. So that's how an ileoconduit is for, in regards to urine. So our continent diversions. So these reservoirs, they're constructed from the ileum, ileocecal segment, or the ascending colon. So large segments of the bowel are going to be altered to help prevent peristaltic action with these. And so with the continent diversion, the patient will need to self-cath. So they don't have to have an outer an outer collection device. They're like an internal pouch. So they would have to go in and kind of self-cath every time to get the urine out. So with this one, the patient can wear like a small bandage over it because sometimes it'll have mucus that will leak from it. So with the orthotopic bladder reconstruction, this is just where a new bladder is completely reconstructed for the patient. So on here, I just have the pictures kind of giving you a visual of what each one of those will look like. So with the nephrostomy, and you guys will probably get to see some of these in the ICU because sometimes they have to do these procedures on some of the critical patients. So it's inserted on a temporary basis, and this is to help try to preserve the renal function whenever a ureter becomes completely obstructed. So with the nephrostomy, it's attached through a small flank incision directly into the pelvis of the kidney, and it's going to be attached to connect tubing for closed drainage. So with these, it's kind of almost similar to a Foley. So with the tubing, we need to make sure the tubing is not kinked, compressed, or clamped because this tubing is very, very small. So if it has any kinks or it becomes compressed, this can ca actually cause damage to the renal pelvis. If the patient starts to have excessive pain in the area, or if there's excessive drainage around the tube, then we need to check the catheter for patency. And so irrigation will be ordered. This is something we would need to have an order for. This is something we can't go and do on our own. So anytime with any urinary devices, irrigation orders must be placed. So the purpose of the irrigation is to prevent over-distension of that kidney, pelvis, and renal damage. So with the irrigation process, we'll use aseptic technique. And so because the tubing is so small and is directly into that pelvis, we would not put no more than 5 mL of saline in at a time because it has low volume within that tube. And so we would not put a whole bunch of fluid in there to irrigate. So complications with nephrostomy can be an infection because, of course, it's something that's inserted internal, so we definitely have to be careful to prevent infection, and secondary stones can form due to having this in place. Now we're going to get into renal failure, and this actually goes into chapter 51. So with renal failure, we have two types: acute renal failure, chronic renal failure, and then we have acute kidney injury, which can lead to either of the two types. So we're going to first talk about acute kidney injury because, of course, this is anytime something happens that causes a disruption in kidney function. And so it's used as a global term because it can classify based off of an acute or chronic condition. So with acute kidney injury, this is when we have a rapid loss of kidney function. Of course, the first thing we're going to see is a rise in serum creatinine, a reduction in urinary output, and azotemia. So azotemia is an accumulation of nitrogenous waste products, so urea, nitrogen, and creatinine in the blood. And so, of course, our most common cause of AKI is acute tubular necrosis. So with acute kidney injury, we have different classifications of the causes. So pre-renal, intrarenal, and post-renal, and we're going to talk about each one of those. But I like how this image kind of shows you, because it shows you where that cause originates from. So of course, if it's pre-renal, you see it's something that happens before it even hits the kidneys. With intrarenal, it's something internal within the kidneys that's causing AKI. And then with post-renal, it's something below the kidneys that is causing acute kidney injury. So let's start with pre-renal. So based off of the image of the previous slide, we see that this is something that ultimately reduces blood flow to the kidneys. So before it even touches the kidney, something, a condition that happens. With pre-renal, we have decreased glomerular perfusion and filtration of the kidney. So you ask yourself, what is going on that's preventing blood flow to the kidneys? So two common aspects we're going to have is pre-renal oliguria and pre-renal azotemia. So with pre-renal oliguria, we don't have any direct damage to the parenchyma. And so the parenchyma is just your kidney tissue. So this could be a result from decreased circulating blood volume. So some examples could be severe dehydration, heart failure, decreased cardiac output. But all of these conditions, this pre-renal oliguria is reversible as long as it's treated properly. So with pre-renal, we do have autoregulatory mechanisms that will try to attempt to preserve the blood flow. So with pre-renal azotemia, this is where we have decreased sodium excretion, increased sodium and water retention, and decreased urinary output. So if the decreased perfusion persists for an extended time, the kidneys can no longer compensate. And so that's when we'll step into our next cause, which is intrarenal. And so with intrarenal, we have direct damage to that parenchyma, that kidney tissue. So our most common cause of intrarenal is acute tubular necrosis. And so this is primarily the result of ischemia, nephrotoxins, or sepsis. So we hear that a lot whenever we see our septic patients. So, and we know that when we talked about septic shock and everything, that decreased blood flow to the kidneys ended up being a part of that Sears process. So with post-renal, this is where we have issues with the flow being obstructed. So urine will reflux into that renal pelvis, and this is what will cause impairment of the kidney function. And so based off of the image, we saw that this was anything that happened below the kidneys. And so, of course, that obstruction will ultimately result in us having direct issues within that kidney, so specifically the renal pelvis, since it's a part of creating urine. So the manifestations for AKI is based off of three different phases. So let's talk about our first phase, which is the oliguric phase. So we know if it's labeled oliguric, of course, we're going to have oliguria. So with the urinary changes, we're going to have an ultimate reduction, and it's going to be less than 400 mils a day. So this usually occurs within 1 to 7 days of the injury to the kidneys, and if the cause is due to ischemia, 24 hours. And so this phase can last 10 to 14 days. The longer the patient is in this oliguric phase, the poorer their prognosis. So the urinalysis, we're going to see some casts, red blood cells, and white blood cells present. So fluid volume. So we know that, of course, with the fluid volume, we have decreased volume. So the hypovolemia, it worsens the AKI, which ultimately decreases urinary output. So the patient will start to retain some of that fluid. So now we're going to start seeing the signs of fluid retention. So the neck veins will become distended. We'll have a bounding pulse with the edema. Of course, hypertension, because everything is working overtime to try to get that blood flowing to everything. And this can ultimately lead to heart failure, pulmonary edema, and we'll start to see pericardial and pleural effusions as well. In regards to metabolic acidosis, and if you're looking at this, look at the image as well as I'm talking about some of this stuff. So with metabolic acidosis, we have impaired kidneys. They can't excrete those hydrogen ions out. So this makes them acidotic. And so bicarb production is going to decrease. And so remember that one of our compensatory mechanisms for metabolic acidosis is that the patient will start to have those Kussmaul respirations that will take place to try to compensate for them being in that acidotic state. Sodium balance. So we have damaged tubules that cannot conserve the sodium. So of course the sodium is going to be just pouring out, and it's our levels within the circulation are going to be low. So we'll start to see hyponatremia. With the condition, with the kidneys not working properly, potassium is going to be in excess. So the potassium levels will increase because they can't be excreted properly, because we know the kidneys, and remember with ROS, potassium is one of the electrolytes that are excreted out. So if they're not working properly, it's going to hold on to potassium. And so we know that potassium affects ECG changes. So peak T waves, widening of the QRS, ST segment depression, hematologic disorders. So leukocytosis, one of the most common causes of death with AKI is going to be infection. So we can, respiratory and urinary systems are going to be common sites for infections. We have waste products accumulation, so the azotemia, so we're going to see an elevated BUN and creatinine, of course. Neurologic disorders, so we have those, the azotemia taking place, so the waste products will start to accumulate in the brain, and so your patient will start to be fatigued and have difficulty concentrating, which places them at risk for seizures, stupor, and coma. So that's just kind of a briefing of what goes on during the oliguric phase. So our next phase is the diuretic phase. So with this phase, we have a daily urine. So we graduate from being an oliguric, so now we're in a diuretic phase. So the urine output is going to be increased. So it'll be 1 to 3 liters a day, and it may can reach up to 5 liters. So what's going on is that the kidneys have recovered the ability to excrete waste, but it doesn't have the ability to concentrate that urine. So we're dumping out tons and tons of unconcentrated urine during this phase. And so we'll start to see hypovolemia and hypotension because with us pouring out this massive amount of fluid, this is decompensating our patient because of the massive fluid loss. So we're going to need to be monitoring electrolytes. So looking at hyponatremia, hypokalemia, and dehydration. So this phase can last 1 to 3 weeks. So near the end of this phase is when the kidneys start to stabilize. And so the last phase is your recovery phase. So kidney function can take up to 12 months for it to stabilize during the recovery phase. So with table 51.3, it talks about how it classifies the different stages of AKI. You guys don't have to know that. Only thing I want you to focus on is the actual three phases of the clinical manifestations of AKI. So when we're diagnosing acute kidney injury, history is always important because we need to know if they've had any significant thing that occurred that led to this. So we're going to be wanting to know, have you recently been dehydrated? Any hypotensive episodes? Have you had any recent blood loss? We're going to be looking at intrarenal causes. Have you had any nephrotoxic drugs or contrast media? Have you had any changes in your urinary stream, any your kidney stones? If they had a history of BPH or prostate cancers. With the serum creatinine, we won't start to see this level increase until about more than 50% of the kidney function is lost. So this is going to be our most important indicator of AKI, not BUN, creatinine. So with urinalysis, we're going to see abundant cells, CAS proteins. We're going to be looking at urine osmolality, the sodium content, specific gravity in urine sediment. So with AKI patients, MRIs, they're going to be contraindicated due to dye because that contrast dye is nephrotoxic to the kidney. So we don't want to put the patient in further renal failure. So patients that are diabetic and are on metformin. So whenever these patients come in, this is why we put those patients on insulin coverage while they're in the hospital, because if they have to have an MRI, we don't need them having metformin in their system. So metformin needs to be held at least 48 hours prior to, and because with metformin and contrast, they can cause contrast-induced nephropathy. So this is why we don't put our patients on metformin in the hospital setting. Now, once they are discharged, they're free to resume it, but during the time while they're in, they're going to be on insulin coverage. So with AKI, our most important thing is that we need to eliminate the cause and manage our signs and symptoms and prevent any complications so the kidneys can recover properly. So we're going to ultimately place the patient on diuretic therapy to kind of help get some of that fluid off if their kidneys can handle it. It's going to be important to calculate fluid restrictions during that time. And as far as hyperkalemia treatments, so our treatments, we have a couple of things that we do. So refer to table 51.5 and it'll have everything listed. So you guys do need to be familiar with these medications as a treatment for hyperkalemia. Nutritional therapy, of course, we're going to limit protein intake because the kidneys can't break down that protein properly. They're going to be on dietary restrictions. So potassium, phosphate, and sodium are things that we're going to restrict them from intaking. We're on a want to put them on a high carb and a low protein diet. So renal replacement therapy, this is just dialysis. So we have our indications listed for whenever dialysis is an option. And so we're going to talk about the different types of dialysis later on in the presentation. With health promotion of AKI, these are going to be some of the things that we're going to be monitoring as a nurse. So with AKI in older clients, one thing that we know is that the older you get, everything starts to decline. GFR is one of those. So GFR, the glomerular filtration rate, this declines with age. So they start to have impaired function of other organs that place them at increased risk for AKI, so coronary vascular disease or diabetes. Aging kidneys, they're less able to compensate for changes in fluid volume, solute load, and cardiac output. So this is why it's kind of harder to manage AKI in older patients. Now, chronic kidney disease. This is when we have progressive irreversible loss of kidney function. So this is where we get more familiar with our GFR, because GFR helps classify what stage of chronic kidney disease the patient is in. So the different stages are on table 51.7, and yes, you are going to need to know them. So once the GFR becomes less than 15 milliliters a minute, this is when we enter end-stage renal disease. So let's talk a little bit about the manifestations for CKD. So as the kidney function deteriorates, that's when all of the body systems start to become affected by it. So these manifestations, they result from the retained urea, creatinine, phenols, hormones, electrolytes, and water that we know the kidneys help rid of. So with them not functioning properly, we have retained those in the system. So uremia. So this is kidney function, where the kidney function will decline to the point that the symptoms may develop in multiple body systems. So that's just a classification of an overall effect of this condition. So remember our nitrogenous waste products that we have an accumulation of, so our BUN and creatinine. So this is where we start to see some of those levels elevated. We will have altered carb metabolism, impaired glucose metabolism. So the patient starts to have like mild to moderate hyperglycemia and hyperinsulinemia. So this just means that they're more prone to not metabolizing insulin if it's given. So this reduction of triglycerides, and so the patient will develop dyslipidemia, so increase in cholesterol levels. So with our acid-base and electrolyte imbalances, of course, we start to see hyperkalemia more common, and we'll start to see fatal dysrhythmias occur whenever the potassium is 7 to 8. Sodium, it could be high, normal, or low, but impaired sodium excretion is going to be what's key with CKD. So sodium is retained with water, so we have hyponatremia. Calcium and phosphates, we'll have less vitamin D, so of course this is going to lead to hypocalcemia. Hyperphosphatemia is going to be common, and so these patients start to have osteomalacia. Magnesium is excreted, but it's not a problem unless it's being ingested. So milk of magnesia and antacids, we need to be careful when they're intaking any of those products. So it can place them at risk for metabolic acidosis. Hematologic conditions, anemia, of course, because we have decreased production of erythropoietin. So in dialysis actually causes anemia as well, because, you know, we're taking the blood, running it through that machine, filtering it properly, and so this can cause anemia. These patients are always going to need iron and folic acid, so this is why we commonly see those folic acid pills or those iron infusions listed on their med list. And so with them having issues, this places them at increased risk for bleeding tendencies. So they, of course, they're going to be at risk for infections due to this. Cardiovascular, of course, their hypertension is going to be worsened by that sodium retention and that increase in that volume in the extracellular fluid. So one of our most common causes of death with our chronic kidney disease patients is cardiovascular disease. So to avoid this, we need to maintain the blood pressure, make sure it's controlled. So some GI issues that they can have, stomatitis, where they have that metallic taste in their mouth, uremic fetor. Uremic fetor is just where they have a urinous odor of the breath, and they can be constipated a lot. Neurologic complications, the CNS system can become depressed from that increase in those waste products. So dialysis usually helps improve CNS symptoms. The patient will have peripheral neuropathy, so restless leg syndrome, muscle twitching, asterixis, that's flapping of the fingers and hands, and skin integrity. So calcium phosphate deposits in the skin. So of course they can easily have skin breakdown. They have dry skin as well. And so sensory neuropathy is also a condition of CKD. So this slide focuses on just the treatments for chronic kidney disease. So we know, of course, controlling blood pressure, glucose levels, making sure the patient avoids being hyperkalemic. So drug therapy is on table 51.9. Once they start to get towards where the GFR is 15 or less, we'll start to go into dialysis being a treatment option for them. Kidney transplant is the ultimate ending treatment if dialysis doesn't work. And so table 51.10 just discusses some dietary changes that these patients will need to make. So first, we're going to just talk about how dialysis works. So with dialysis, this treatment option is the step for whenever the kidneys can no longer filter, because remember, our kidneys help filter the blood and everything. So with dialysis, this condition, not condition, this treatment is just where we have movement of fluid and molecules across a semipermeable membrane from one compartment to another. So we have various methods for dialysis, but the entire process has three parts. So diffusion, the first part. So with diffusion, this is where urea, creatinine, uric acid, and electrolytes, specifically potassium and phosphate. So they'll move from the blood to the diastolate with the net effect of lowering their concentration in the blood. So with osmosis, this is where glucose in the diastolate is going to pull the excess fluid from the blood. And so the ultrafiltration, this is where we have water and fluid that's being removed. So peritoneal dialysis, this is a form of dialysis treatment, and a lot of patients that do peritoneal dialysis, they do it at home. So they've been trained on how to work their machines and everything, and how to access themselves at home. So a catheter is going to be inserted through the anterior abdominal wall. And so the way it works is where the dialysate solution is placed into the peritoneal space, and it has the three different phases that it's going to do. So let's talk about those phases. So we have two types. We have automated and continuous. So with automated, this is going to allow the patient to do the dialysis while they're sleeping. So the patient will disconnect from the machine in the morning, and they'll leave the fluid in their abdomen during the day. Versus continuous, this is done every few hours during the day, so the patient can perform an exchange of 2 liters or peritoneal diastolate 4 times daily. So their dwell times are at averaging 4 hours, so they have a common schedule of like 7 a.m., 12 noon, 5 p.m., and 10 p.m. So the different parts, so the inflow, this is where they actually start to fill themselves with the fluid. In the dwell, this is the equilibrium, so this is where they leave the fluid inside and the exchange will take place. And so the drain is where they drain themselves that drain the fluid back out. So with ultrafiltration, our most common fluid that they like to use is dextrose, because we need to draw some of the extra fluid off, usually with peritoneal dialysis. So with peritoneal, there are complications that come from doing this type of treatment. So of course, site infection. That's going to be one of our common ones. So this is why we need to educate the patient on properly using proper hand hygiene, making sure that they're disinfecting themselves. They're using alcohol whenever they're hooking themselves up and unhooking themselves, because we don't want them to develop peritonitis. So peritonitis is just where a bacteria will get into that peritoneum cavity and cause infection. So there are different ways this can happen, so we need to make sure that they are aware of it. So we have the signs listed here that shows how this condition will appear. Hernias can develop, and the hernias, they can be a result of carrying that extra fluid in their cavity all night or throughout the day. So that can cause some bulging in that abdominal space. So carrying that heavy fluid, of course, will lead to them having lower back problems, because that's a heavy weight. It's kind of like carrying a baby around. There are, of course, going to be areas for bleeding. They can have pulmonary complications because the diaphragm, you know, is located above that abdominal space. So they can have some issues with breathing if too much fluid is in that abdominal cavity. And so, of course, protein loss is also going to be a complication of this procedure. So hemodialysis is going to be our next type of dialysis treatment, but first we need to know the different axes for hemodialysis. So our first one is our arteriovenous fistula, and so this is our most common one. So it's created on a forearm or upper arm, and so it has an anastomosis between an artery and vein. And so it allows arterial blood to flow through that vein. So this is essential to help provide rapid blood flow for hemodialysis. Whenever these are placed, they need at least 6 weeks to mature. So this is not something that's done and they can dialyze with it the same day. So if a fistula has to be placed, usually they'll put in a temporary catheter, which is called a Quinn catheter, and which I'll show you on the next slide. But with our AV fistulas, thrill and Brewey are going to be our two key assessments with it. So the thrill can be felt by palpating that fistula. So whenever you press it, if any of you have ever done it before, you should feel like a whooshing feel of that blood. Is almost like a very intense heartbeat. And so the Brewey, this can be heard with a stethoscope. And so this is where you're gonna hear that brewing, rushing sound. So when we're assessing, we should feel the thrill and hear the Brewey. So with the AV graft, this is, we don't usually see a lot of these, but it's more of a use with synthetic material, but it takes less time to heal, but they are more at risk for infection and blood clots with this, because this is something that's artificial that's placed inside. So if it's infected, they'll have to have surgical interventions to have it removed. So some safety alerts with our fistulas. We'd never want to perform blood pressure measurements on whatever arm that fistula is in. IV line insertions or venipunctures, they should not be done in that same extremity that they have AV access. So these special precautions are taken to help prevent infection and clotting of that vascular access. So usually when a patient is in the hospital, if they're out on the regular floor, or usually in the ICU, we may put a little sign out on the door and the window that says no blood pressure, blood draws, or IV in whatever specific extremity it is, but that needs to be communicated. Temporary vascular access, these are placed in different parts, but they're referred to as a Quinn catheter. So They would put this, if a patient had a newly placed fistula, they would put in one of these Quinn catheters as a temporary measure. So patients should not be discharged home with this. So it has the two lumens. One is for blood removal and the other will be used for blood return. So the procedure for hemodialysis, so they use two large bore needles, usually 16 gauge, to insert into the fistula or the graft. And so they're color coordinated, so they usually have a blue and a red. So one is going to pull blood and the other is going to return. So the dialysis machines, they have a heparin pump on it because we're pulling that blood out. So of course, we don't want it to clot, so the heparin is going to be necessary. So the cartridge, the dialysis cartridge, that is what actually filters the blood. So during hemodialysis, there are some important things that we're going to be assessing. So fluid status, we're going to make sure we need a wait before and after dialysis. Blood pressure is going to be something that we're going to be monitoring. Peripheral edema, heart and lung sounds, all of these are going to be important that we document before, during, and after the treatments. So usually patients that do hemodialysis, they're on a three-day schedule. I've never seen a four-day. So either Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday schedule. And dialysis treatments usually run from 3 to 4 hours. It's based off of the doctor's orders. So complications of this, the patient can be at risk for hypotension due to us, you know, pulling off all their volume and recirculating it through a machine. Of course, they could have issues with volume, muscle cramps, loss of blood. Remember, dialysis patients with hemodialysis, they could become anemic from it. And hepatitis, but it's a risk, a complication of it, but that's a long reach for that to actually happen. So continuous renal replacement therapy, table 51.13 talks about the different types. So this is just whenever the patient is on continuous dialysis over 24 hours. So one of our most common ones, which we see it for in general, is CVVHD. And so they're categorized based off of what the doctor wants done. So remember we talked about the different phases of dialysis, how we have a dwelling, and with like ultrafiltration. So that's why they categorize different, because it's kind of based off of what the doctor wants to happen. If the patient has to have continuous renal replacement therapy, they have to be in the ICU because that means that they are critically ill. So we need to continuously run this therapy on them. And so we need a vascular access. With this one, they usually don't like to do CRRT through a fistula, but if they have to, they will, especially if the patient is like severely septic. But we like to do it through a temp cath, so that cath can either be placed in the jugular or the femoral vein. So the filter, it'll remove the plasma water and non-protein solutes. And so I've shown you guys the different type of dialysates at Far's General in there. So they're based off of whatever doctor prefers at that point. But with CRRT, we use this to kind of help improve their hemodynamic stability. So this is why we can kind of run it slower to kind of keep them balanced while they're doing this treatment.